Hi, everybody. Today is Tuesday, April 22nd, 2025, and our friend Pepe Escobar is back with us. Welcome back, Pep.
Hey! Welcome to Hong Kong, everybody, and also Nima. So I'm back. I was telling Nima before the start, this is my home, one of my homes. I lived here on and off for many years, so coming back here is always coming back home, and of course, drinking first-class tea. And what a time to be in Hong Kong now. Wow. And coming from Shanghai on top of it. So, you know, it's being in the middle of the hurricane, of everything. I barely sleep. You don't have time to sleep. It's too much happening. Okay, Nima, go.
Yeah. As you've mentioned, there is a lot to talk about. And the first and the most important thing would be this tariff war and the economic war between the United States and China. As you're there in China, how do they feel about the United States right now? And the way we know that the Chinese experts are just talking directly to the United States, they're saying, whatever you're going to do, we're going to go to the end to fight you. How does it feel to be in China?
Oh, I tried, Dima, in my first column that came out yesterday in the middle of the night in Russia, in fact. So I don't even know the timeline anymore, but in the past few hours. My first column is trying exactly to answer your question. And the mood in China is defiant, resistance. We're not going to take any bullying anymore. The century of humiliation is a long, long time ago. It will never come back, and especially not from the British Empire this time, from these bloody barbarians. They are openly calling the Americans barbarians. Not only taxi drivers, but high-ranking diplomats and some of the best political analysts in China. So my experience in Shanghai before coming here, it's great to for all of you, our audience. I am in Hong Kong now, but after spending over a week in Shanghai and bombarded with information from the best possible sources, academic at Fudan University, especially in terms of media, Guansha, which is the best news analysis website in China. I visited them, met the new editor. We had a session together. They interviewed me. We had a lunch together. We followed up one of their top podcasts together, which was an absolute bomb. I linked to it in my column. And business people. Shanghai, as many of you will know, is not only the cultural capital of China, but the business and trade capital of China. Trade, but not the only one, as you all know. Guess what's happening at my neighbors up north here? By, I would say, 35 to 40-minute high-speed train ride from where I am now. The Canton Fair in Guangzhou, in Guangdong province, which borders, of course, Hong Kong. 60,000 merchants, producers, manufacturers gathering in an absolutely gigantic space age hall. And guess who's there, Nima? Buyers from over 200 countries. This is what we call the art of the real art of the deal is a place like this, the Canton Fair, where people from all over the world go to buy all the manufactured products made in China, all the tech now made in China. They're selling a lot of tech. They're selling robots all over the place. It's amazing. Yeah, half of the cents, they're selling robots, for instance. Artificial intelligence all over the place. And that's it. So no wonder many Chinese, and when I say many, I mean hundreds of millions, they are saying, guess who's running the show now? We are running the show. And they are. They are running the trade show all over the world. And now, which is something very important, that all these conversations in Shanghai, they more or less, they were always going to the same point and to the same framework and almost a kind of consensus, but not coming from the top. No, for instance, I didn't talk to any officials in China. I didn't talk to any representatives of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So of course, we read them every day. I was the people at Guansha, which is excellent, and the China Academy, which has a direct connection with Guansha, they framed themselves as independent. They are not private, because of course the media system in China, they keep an eye on everything, as you all know, Nima, and many of our audience. But they have a leeway in a measure of independence that official media, for instance, the Global Times, they don't have. The former editor of the Global Times, now he's the editor of Guansha. I met him. Wonderful guy with enormous experience. And now he feels great because even with Global Times, he had some constraints. Now with Guansha, he can publish anything he wants. And the great thing about Guansha is that they publish, let's say, heretic academics and different academic point of views from different from the best universities in China. Very, very critical, not only of the West, but also critical of what may be improved inside China, which is the same Deng Xiaoping mindset of crossing the river while feeling the stones and learning from your mistakes. And the Chinese are always perfecting themselves and learning from their mistakes. And one thing in terms of a huge mistake that they will never, never, never reproduce is to take it lie down the latest round of what is being interpreted all over China as extreme disrespect to Chinese people, to the Chinese civilization state, to the system of international relations, to the system of an international system of trade relations, and the basic rules of diplomacy. They are very, very angry, Nima. I've never seen it like this in front of me, you know, and manifested at every level. It was fascinating. Sometimes I was having, for instance, I was exploring one of the we call it in Chinese model quarters. These were buildings of the built during the Maoist era, where we had the functionary of the party at the entrance, you know, checking everything in and out, who's living there, etc. They were, let's say, socialist houses or socialist compounds, and they're still there in Shanghai, but of course in a private enterprise manner. Right. And many people that still left, they remember the 60s, the 70s. They remember the beginning of the reforms by Deng in the late 70s. And now they talk with much pride, not only about Shanghai, which is in terms of a big metropolis, the infrastructure is absolutely mind boggling. How efficient, how impeccable everything is in terms of the metro, in terms of electric buses, in terms of the all of them green electric taxes that you will call on Alipay. You get a DD on Alipay. 3-4 minutes later, you have an impeccable taxi, clean as hell, the driver impeccably dressed, etc. So the infrastructure is amazing, absolutely amazing, and everything works. All over the city. So it's one of the most efficient big metropolises on the planet. Beautiful as well, because it was many tracts of Shanghai were rebuilt. There are wonderful parks everywhere. It's a green city. There are parks all over the place. Like you know, I was in a very privileged place. I was at the Jin Mao Tower. There are three big towers in Pudong on the other side of the Huangpu River. The Jin Mao is the Art Deco tower. It was inaugurated in the late 90s. Then there's the big one, which is around and going like this, is the World Financial Center, you know, right in front of us. So from my point of view, I was at the dead center of business in China, not only in Shanghai, but in China. And from over there, if you go, for instance, one of our business dinners was at the Uyghur Xinjiang restaurant in the World Financial Center. And it was a business there of a big Chinese company linked to European business as well. So it was fascinating to talk to all these executives and sales representatives. We're talking about trade, but we're talking about obviously the tariffs as well. Once again, the consensus. Now, that's it. It's our turn. We are running this show, and we're not going to let a bunch of barbarians dictate terms for us. And we have partners all over the world. And something that when you discuss with them, they really appreciate. They don't know the details. When we tell them, look, you have support in Latin America. You have support in Africa. You know very well that you have support around Southeast Asia, your neighbors in Southeast Asia. So your support is nearly global. And even Europeans are looking at you and say, oh, shit, we're going to need to send a high-level delegation to China. In fact, they will do that in June or July. And let's strike a new trade deal. A new EU-China trade deal. This is going to happen because of the tariffs as well. So the mood as a whole was immensely impressive. And I got this distinct sensation, impression, and certainty from their part that we are now the front line of global resistance in terms of trade and in terms of diplomacy against these barbarians, and the world is with us. This in terms of the Chinese attitude in international relations, Nima and all of you, this is unparalleled. It's now they look at their trade, financial, economic power. They say, who are we to be lying down when these bloody barbarians try to clobber up, you know? No way, not anymore. So, wow. And, you know, yesterday, for instance, I was looking at the beginning of all this strategy from a Chinese point of view. I used to live in Hollywood Road for a while, which is nearby here. It's about a 20-minute walk from where I am. I am in downtown central Hong Kong. And Hollywood Road was the first road in Hong Kong. Was built by the Brits. And you know why they built this road? Because a few years before, they landed on a stretch of the island that they called Possession. So the path that led to Hollywood Road was called Possession Street. So this is where the British Empire took possession of the island of Hong Kong. Never something like this will happen again, even metaphorically, Nima. It's a very, very important landmark. I took a photo of the Hollywood plaque with the dates, how the when they landed, when they built the road and all that. And I was connecting immediately with my experience in Shanghai the days before. There will never be another century of humiliation. They learned their historical lesson. And now they know that they can rewire the chains of production, the system of trade relations, everything. And if they had, if this famous decoupling from the American economy has to happen, so much the better for them. They don't care anymore. All of that is unparalleled in the 21st century. I imagine the ghost of Deng Xiaoping when he started those reforms in 1968, if he would know that we will get to this point so fast. We're still in 2025, which is very, very early. Deng Xiaoping's plan for China to become a middle-income society, very stable and with a global reach, is 2049. We're halfway and China is already there.
Pepe, when you look at the economy of China, you find it somehow in the middle of the private economy and we have the government controlling everything. Which one is more powerful? Is the government one, the socialist or the communist one, or the private one?
It's a mix of all, Nima. We still have state-owned enterprises that are immensely powerful, especially in strategic sectors of the Chinese economy. We have public-private partnerships, and you have enormous private companies like Ant and like Jack Ma's and Bayer, which are as powerful as a conglomerate of state-owned enterprises. It's this is the crux of socialism with Chinese characteristics. You can say that to a certain extent, sometimes it looks like neoliberalism with Chinese characteristics. So it's a mix of both, actually. Obviously, all the major strategic sectors of the Chinese economy, they will always be run by state-owned enterprises. There's no question about that. But there are niches here and there where there is competition from everywhere. No problem. And here in Hong Kong, it's even more interesting. But it's very hard to give a concise definition of Hong Kong in relation to China. Hong Kong used to be the middleman until the handover in 1997, and even in the first few years after the handover in 1997, the middleman between the West and China. Business had to come through Hong Kong. Not anymore. Businesses, the Western business, they go straight to China to do business in China. They go to Guangzhou, they go to Shanghai, they go to Beijing and Tianjin and the north, they go to Sichuan directly. They don't need Hong Kong anymore. What Hong Kong sells very, very well is lots of services, financial services, propaganda, PR, soft power, marketing, photography, much more than specific trading. And of course, this is a world-class port. But it's not the number one port in China anymore. Shanghai, the Shanghai port has more movement, moves more a cargo than Hong Kong port, which in itself is, wow, it's mind-boggling. It's a monster, this port. But it's great because you have cargo from all over the world coming here to stack up on Chinese products, especially from the Eastern Seaboard and the Guangdong province, and then going across the Pacific and all the way to other parts of the West as well. But this was not as important as it was until a few years ago. So what the Chinese government was thinking, okay, we need to integrate Hong Kong to Southern China, Guangdong province, our neighbors here to the north. And they came up with the fabulous concept of Greater Bay Area. That's how you qualify 10 cities in the Pearl River Delta, plus Hong Kong, and including Macau and Zhuhai as well. That famous 50-kilometer bridge from Hong Kong to Zhuhai was inaugurated only a few years ago. So this will be an enormous cluster of development for Southern China for the foreseeable future. The problem is, Nima, is that some of the elites here in Hong Kong, they are too Atlanticist for that and too linked to Western interests for that. So it's a huge problem for the Chinese government to convince these oligarchs, and they are de facto oligarchs. And look, your future is not with the West. Your future is part of China. You are a special administrative region of China, and you are Chinese. And you have been Chinese since the handover in 1997. So get over it, you know. Many of them didn't get over it until, 2019, when there was a color revolution here. Very, very serious. And at the time when I came to cover the color revolution, I was traveling around, then I came back here to specifically cover and unlock the mysteries of the color revolution here. So one day I sat down with one of the members of the old aristocracy in Hong Kong, which I had known since the handover times in the 90s. And where from? Very important. From Shanghai. Because the wealth, not only cultural, but the international connections, and even in many ramifications of trade in Hong Kong, the wealth came from Shanghai, much more than from Guangzhou, from Guangdong province, the neighbors, and even from Hong Kongers themselves. So the role of Shanghai in the explosion of Hong Kong is absolutely essential. Some of the top families here, they are Shanghainese, you know. So he told me, look, these, he didn't use barbarians, he said, these freaks, these punks are destroying my city. We built the wealth of the city. And now the Americans with their hired guns are trying to destroy our city. We won't let that happen. And exactly, this is not, this is exactly what happened afterwards. The call of revolution was quashed mercilessly by the Hong Kong government with help of Chinese intelligence as well. They mounted an intel cell in Shenzhen across the border. They monitored all the leaders of the color revolution. They made the connection between these leaders with the American embassy here. So it was a very, very sophisticated intel operation. And then they destroyed the leadership. And then, of course, but this was only a few years ago. So Hong Kong is still recovering from that. After that, there was COVID. So now Hong Kong is the beginning of the recovery. And now they have to focus on being this special pole of the Greater Bay Area in terms of developing even more this whole southern region of China, southeast region of China, and selling their expertise to Shanghai, to Beijing, to the Chinese government, so they can apply the best techniques, especially of marketing and soft power, etc., to the benefit of China. So there is an intricate relationship, but it's very complex, Nima, very complex. And you feel it when you move from Shanghai and come here, it's practically two universes. It's not to mention that they speak Cantonese, which is another linguistic universe as well, and another way of thinking, completely different. And of course, the people from the South, Cantonese from the South, and especially Cantonese from Hong Kong, they always have a certain aversion towards the North. And when I mean the North, not Shanghai, Beijing. So the relationship between Hong Kong and Beijing is very complex. Relation between Hong Kong and Shanghai is much easier, especially because you have generation of Shanghainese here and made the city wealthy, right? So this is a short explanation to all of you of the inner complexities of China. But now, for instance, today I was reading the South China Morning Post, which used to be my local newspaper for many years. And even when you read the opinion columns, you see that now we have to get our act together because the Americans are attacking all of us, including us here in Hong Kong. And it doesn't matter that the Americans are ever present here in Hong Kong. Hong Kong, in many aspects, is an American city as well. But now the people who run businesses here and the oligarchs who run business in Hong Kong, they have to start thinking strategically in terms of being Chinese, essentially, and not Hong Kong separate from China anymore. So this is one of the big changes of these past few days and weeks.
And when is she going to call to Donald Trump? Is
he never? Going? Never. I'm sure you got the official Ministry of Foreign Relations definition, right? A tariff-wielding barbarian can never expect China to make a call. This is the official Ministry of Foreign Relations position in Beijing. And these past few days, they have been saying more or less the same thing, a little more diplomatically, but it hasn't changed. Why it hasn't changed and why it won't change? Because China was prepared for it. And it was prepared not since the beginning of Trump 2.0, since the beginning of Trump 1.0. I remember very well at the time, I was still working with Asia Times, based here in Hong Kong. So I was coming here, I was between Asia and Southeast Asia and Hong Kong all the time, and going to China as well. So when Trump launched the first tariffs against China, the Chinese were already expecting it. even before Trump came to power. So now this is a replay. So they are even more prepared now, Nima, for the replay. They built their international connections, especially with the Southeast Asian neighbors, the ASEAN 10, Association of Southeast Asian Nations, the 10 nations, in across Central Asia, with Latin America, with Africa. So, you know, they have a global, let's say, Friends of China network, which we have a mix of multilateral organizations and direct contacts by the Chinese government. So we get BRICS into the mix, of course. We have the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. We have the members of the New Silk Roads of the Belt and Road Initiative. Over 150 nations are official partners of the Belt and Road Initiative. And we have missions, trade missions, and diplomatic missions of the Chinese government going everywhere. Where was Xi Jinping last week? In Southeast Asia. He visited three very important Southeast Asian nations, Malaysia, Vietnam, and Cambodia. Cambodia and Vietnam were hit very hard by the American tariffs. There's a lot of foreign direct investment from China in Cambodia. So they will help the Cambodians. Vietnam, the same thing. The relationship between Hanoi and Beijing now is very good. For the first time in, I could even say, centuries. Seriously, you know. And they know that an attack on China is an attack on Southeast Asia as well. In Malaysia, the same thing. In Malaysia, now that they have Anwar, which is a very, very good prime minister, very close with Vladimir Putin as well, and close with Xi Jinping. So ASEAN and China, they are building a strategy together to counteract the tariffs. So we can say, even now, with a measure of certainty, that Trump has already lost half of Asia. If you count China, if you count Southeast Asia, that's the most productive part of Asia. We're not talking about India. India is a basket case. It's completely different. And we're not talking about Central Asia. Economy is much smaller. And we're still not talking about West Asia because, as you know, West Asia is mired into the Zionist war against everybody. So that's another story. But the most important economic parts of Asia, China has already won. And of course, there's Iran. And this is something that it's a pity that you're not coming, Nima. I'm very sorry about that. But I'll be in Iran next week. So it will be great for all of us who are going to Iran in the next few days to see from Iran, not only all the Iranian related issues, domestic economy, nuclear program, etc., but Iran-China relationships. And how Iran, China, and Russia, they're all under sanctions, tariffs, you name it. So now there is a front between these top three BRICS to counteract the Americans at every level, geopolitical, geoeconomic, trade, finance, etc. So, and obviously, Iran for China is a matter of national security, because Iran is one of the top energy providers to China. And Iran is a member of the New Silk Roads as well. And Iran is one of the crossroads for exports from China going to West Asia and then to Europe. So Iran's role is immensely important in China. And it will be great to talk about this with the Iranians. Well, as you can see, this is all interlinked. You know, if there is one positive aspect of this tariff dementia, is that it served to solidify different levels of union and cooperation among most Asian nations and most global South nations. We can even start to talk about a sort of united global South front to fight against the imperial dementia. And this is fascinating because do you know who used the terminology united front from the 50s to this, especially in the 60s, all the way to the early 70s? Mao Zedong. And now there is a revival of Mao in China, which is an absolutely fascinating phenomenon. It requires that we have to go deep into it. And I would like to get into the post-ideological aspect of this revival of not Maoism per se, but Mao's slogans, Mao's predictions. One of them, for instance, that is revealing itself to be absolutely brilliant, that the US is a paper tiger. Everybody now in China, even on TikTok, is saying that US is a, now the US is even more a paper tiger than they were in the 60s and 70s. The concept is brilliant. It is a paper tiger. And the desperate tariff dementia is a sign of desperation from a desperate empire, from a paper tiger. It's not a real tiger anymore. And you, when you see diplomats at the Ministry of Foreign Relations in Beijing using this tiger terminology, some declinations of it, that's absolutely fascinating. And it points to this continuum in Chinese history where you cannot simply erase Maoism. No way. Without Maoism, there would not have been industrialization of China. With all the mistakes involved, with all the tragedies involved, we know that, including the Cultural Revolution. But Deng picked up on that to start building the reforms and start building the renaissance of China as a big trading power. So this continuum is absolutely fundamental. So when you see a so-called analysis of China by this absolutely pathetic so-called Chinese experts in the think tanks of the US, they miss the point completely. Absolutely. Once again, it's not a matter of defending the excesses of Maoism. Nothing to do with that. But you have to see what Mao had in mind in terms of turning a nation of peasants into an industrial power, to what extent he succeeded, and to what extent this was the, let's say, the philosophical stone for Deng Xiaoping to pick it up and say, okay, now it's our drive to start developing and to product. To make productive capitalism with in socialism, let's say productive socialism with a few capitalist characteristics. And of course, you know, go back to what we were before. We were always a big trading power. So it's all there, you know, it's a sequence. And now Xi Jinping, which in many aspects, he looks back at Mao, he learns lessons from Mao, and he reapplies these lessons with a different terminology, but with the same idea. And the idea, the basic idea, is a stable, solid China with connections all over the world as a stable, trustworthy, diplomatic, geopolitical, geoeconomic, financial, and trade power. Can you imagine? This is what is called a vision for a state, Nima. It's enormous. It's huge. It has a lot of problems. For instance, I'm reading this book now. So I'm not promoting this book. On the contrary, I want to destroy it in writing. It was written by two Atlanticist Chinese guys from the School of Oriental and African Studies in London, which is basically MI6. I have many sons of friends of mine studied at SOAS. And they're trying to basically paint Xi Jinping as a new Mao, which is total bullshit. So what I want to do is to finish reading this book, which is interesting. For instance, you cannot find this book in Shanghai. I found it here at my favorite bookshop in Hong Kong. That's great, because you need to know what the enemy is thinking. And the enemy in this case is Chinese academics working in the West. There are still many, and some of them are influential. And some of them, because they only read themselves in a bubble. So then we see, opinion pages in the big papers, it could be Financial Times or Washington Post or whatever, influenced by these people. and their very, very misguided analysis. So I bought the book to read it and then deconstruct it. But the thesis behind it is Chinese who don't understand what she's trying to do in China. And to understand that, not only, for instance, you learn more in 1 week in Shanghai than in 10 years in any university, listening from businessmen, from academics, from PhD graduates. For instance, I had a debate. It was not a debate. We had a seminar with Professor Zhang Weiwei at Fudan University. Professor Zhang Weiwei, a very good friend, he is the conceptualizer of the notion of China as a civilization state. So we had a seminar discussing Russia-China strategic partnership, and then we had a roundtable with PhD students. It was myself and four PhD students, and then immediately I said, look, let's open to the floor. And the questions from the PhD students on the floor, wow, better than anything you read on Western media about China. At the highest level in different disciplines, you know, not necessarily only international relations and political science PhDs, from everything, from technical expertise, etc. So you learn more with an interaction like that than reading 10 books like this, you see. But of course, you have to do the comparisons all the time. And Hong Kong is good for that, especially when you come from China. You spend some time in China, you come to Hong Kong, and then you can compare the extremely westernized way in Hong Kong of looking at China with the real China that you just saw. Well, this is what I did these past 2 weeks. You know, you learn nonstop.
How do they see the two conflicts in Ukraine and in the Middle East? Do they really find it as a war against them? Or they see it as a regional war, regional conflict, which doesn't that much influence China?
They see it essentially, Nima, as, let's say, a starter in the menu against a bigger war against them in the future. This is absolutely essential. This is the way the Politburo sees it. This is the way, I would say, some of the best academics, Tsinghua, Renmin University, Fudan, etc., see it. And it comes down almost to a, I wouldn't say a popular level, but to the level of a well-informed citizen in a big city like Shanghai, with access to excellent discussions on social media, on Weibo, on the chats of different channels. Just to give an idea, the numbers are mind-boggling. The people at Guansha told me that they have several channels in several platforms. So it's not only the website. The website is only a small part of the bigger thing, you know. They told me that when you add up the views that they have in all their channels, all the sub-channels, different platforms, and stuff, they reach 200 million people. And this is one media. So it's absolutely mind-boggling, that the reach of it. And they discuss everything. The comment section at Guansha is it's fabulous. It's really, really good. And they discuss in depth, much more in depth than if you read the comment section of the South China Morning Post here. Much, much better, infinitely better, you know. And they are self-critical as well. It's not only apologies of the Communist Party and all. No. Self-critical. So this is very important. So in terms of the war, the official position of Beijing vis-a-vis the war in Ukraine, very touchy subject. That a second approach to your question. For instance, I was reading the analysis of Colonel Zhou Bo, based in Beijing, very famous. I met him in Astana over a year ago at the forum in Astana. We had a wonderful conversation. Guy's ultra sharp, ultra smart. And his latest op-ed, he's basically, it's very hardcore on Russia. He's basically saying that in 3 years, Russia was unable to win a war against Ukraine, which is technically correct. Of course, it doesn't get into details of why Russia chose to fight the war this way. It doesn't get there. It just goes to the to what's obvious in front of us. And he proposes a solution, if there is a ceasefire, in terms of having a peacekeeping force. He proposes that China leads the peacekeeping force, which is something extraordinary in terms of, for the first time, we're going to have an enormous Chinese contingent in one of the hottest hotspots in the world as a peacekeeping force and coordinating with other members. It's a very, very interesting idea. If he writes this, it's because people up there, you know, he has a green line to write something like this, because it is influential, it's going to circulate a lot. But most Chinese intellectuals, they prefer to see it, of course, as Russia having its own reasons for the SMO. Their methodology is something that is strictly Russian. The Chinese not necessarily would use the same methodology, but they understand that Russia had to start the SMO because they were under total pressure and there would be a NATO blitzkrieg against Donbass. So they understand the motivation, right? As to the how China should support Russia, they don't get into much detail. And this is because this is a very tricky subject across China. A lot of people say that China should be more forceful supporting Russia. And at the same time, a lot of influential people say, no, we should be totally out of it. And because it's in terms of our partners in the Global South, many would not understand if we were more forceful. But it's an extremely touchy subject. And we don't have, I would say, a consensual view like we now have a consensual view all across every spectrum of Chinese society vis-a-vis the American tariffs. Completely different situation.
They've been learning from the conflict in Ukraine. Many people, military officers, were in Russia to learn about how Russia is fighting the United States and NATO. That was hugely beneficial for China.
Of course it is, Nima. Absolutely. They are learning military lessons, you know, by the dozen. No question about that. And of course, this is at the level of the strategic partnership. For instance, we don't know in detail on both sides what the Russian Ministry of Defense shares with the Chinese Ministry of Defense. No, nobody knows that for sure, not even military specialists on both sides. But they are learning a lot, absolutely. And at the same time, they know that the conditions, the situation, and the formations and everything, the battlefield in Ukraine cannot possibly be compared if the battlefield becomes the South China Sea. They know that also very, very well. But they are learning about new strategies. They are learning about drones, which, by the way, they are very good at manufacturing, etc. They are learning about hypersonic missiles, which, of course, the Russians have the best in the world, you name it. And of course, they are talking at the level of Minister of Defense all the time.
What's so fascinating to me, Pepe, in terms of the relationship between Russia, China, and Iran, as we saw it between Iran and Russia, Iran decided to help Russia with the drones and all of that. And they didn't have any sort of 3D strategic partnership. It seems that the relationship is just ahead of treaties. And do you see that would be the case for the case of Russia and China?
It's different.
They don't just talking about it, but it exists below the surface, and it's far beyond the partnership. It's something beyond the partnership. It's something beyond alliance.
Yes, it is beyond the partnership. For instance, Russia and China, they're always saying, Wang Yi said that a few days ago, like the relationship is so good that we don't even need a treaty. It's true, because they talk about every possible, you know, node of a strategic partnership at different levels and different disciplines all the time, at every level and at the highest level, including, of course, Putin and Xi themselves. There are regular phone calls. And which with Iran and Russia is different, because actually there is a written treaty, which, by the way, is not a military alliance. I wrote that in my last column about it. Was one last month, I think. Very, very important. But they started discussing this, what became a treaty, over 2 years ago. So they discussed this over and over again. And while they were discussing, they were collaborating already militarily. And in terms of China and Iran, that's, I would say, that's hazier as an adversary. They have a strategic partnership, but it's delimited to certain areas, from energy to the penetration of the New Silk Roads in Iran, and Iran as a crossroads for the New Silk Roads to West Asia and to Europe. So the relationship between these three, they are at different levels. But as you said, they discuss everything all the time. And it goes way beyond a simple, let's say, formal partnership or treaty or alliance. And now that the three are being attacked by the empire at the same time, at different levels, it's no wonder that they had the first meeting in Beijing and then the second meeting in Moscow about the Iranian nuclear program before these indirect conversations in Oman. This is a graphic example that they are talking about everything that it's important and that affects all three at the same time. A possible attack against Iran is an attack against BRICS, is an attack against Russia and China as well. Everybody knows that very, very well. So they have to discuss a common approach. And for instance, this in parallel to the common approach between China and Southeast Asia to fight the tariffs. So really, we can see a BRICS-led and BRICS-style, everyone on the table discussing everything all the time in front of us. And especially now, in the run-up towards the BRICS summit in Rio, which could become a groundbreaker. If the Brazilians do it right, in the beginning of this year, everybody was looking at, oh, summit in Rio in early July, this is a joke. But now, they have a chance to produce something, a bombshell coming out of Rio. All the elements are there. And all the big, big players are there. And this American attack concerns all of them. So it's an attack against BRICS. The Trump tariff war is an attack against the Global South. It's a hybrid war against the Global South that is developing into a hot war against BRICS as a whole. We knew that before. And now we have 100% confirmation about what we suspected before the beginning of the Trump organization. I have Trump organization in mind, the Trump administration. By the way, Trump himself doesn't know what ASEAN is and what BRICS is. So that gives you his frame of mind and how he is completely, bumbled about by his xenophobe advisors, like Miran, like Peter Navarro, even like Treasury Secretary Bessent, who know nothing about China, all these, you know, together. So that's dangerous. And the fact that Trump, his attention span is, as we all know, minimalistic. And he doesn't read. And obviously, he's never going to read about how BRICS was formed, what BRICS wants to do, the expansion of BRICS, etc. Same about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which Trump doesn't even suspect exist. And of course, ASEAN, which he should know, he doesn't. So that's complicated. Once again, the rational actors on one side against an irrational circus organizer on the other. So now it's time for not only China and ASEAN get their act together, but these three top BRICS get their act together, and the BRICS as a whole get their act together before the summit in Rio. So we have tangible results, which of course will infuriate the empire even more. And I'm not even talking about de-dollarization, because they will never announce this at the summit, for instance. But they can announce testing and improving different mechanisms related to settlements and payment payment mechanisms bypassing the US dollar. And this will infuriate Trump and the ruling elites of empire, but then it will be too late, because this would be a concerted BRICS response to the tariff war.
In terms of the dollarization that you've mentioned, I think they'll do it before talking about it. This is the
of course, Dima, you don't need to talk about it. It's just like the Chinese approach, Made in China 2025. We are in 2025. Made in China 2025 was conceptualized 10 years ago. So Trump comes to power in the beginning of 2017. He looks around and says, we have to do something against China. 2018, the first batch of mega tsunami of sanctions, Trump 1.0 against China. And many of them were related to Made in China 2025, which essentially, China wanted to become number one in 10 different high-tech domains by, or number two, or among the top three by 2025. What the Chinese did, they continued to do everything that they were doing before, and they stopped talking about Made in China 2025. So what's happening now? They are already number one in 7 of these domains. They're about to become number one in the 8th, and in 2 years max, in the other two. And on artificial intelligence, there's a huge debate of who's ahead. Maybe they are neck to neck. But for instance, very simple example. Guess who went to Beijing last week? I included this in my column because it's an immensely important information connected to the Chinese reaction to the Trump tariff war. Jensen Huang, the CEO of NVIDIA. He's Taiwanese. I'm reading a book about him at the moment. The guy who wrote the book, okay. But the technical information in the book is excellent, because he tracks the technical highway followed by Huang since the beginning of his career. And since he was a poor Taiwanese immigrant who went to a school in the middle of Kentucky, that kind of stuff. So the story is amazing. The guy is the personification of the American dream. He is a technical genius. He doesn't take any bullshit. And he's absolutely sure of what he's doing. What did he do last week? He never wears a business suit. He put on a business suit. He went to Beijing with his top executives. He talked to a hyper minister of commerce and trade in Beijing. And he said directly, look, China is very important for NVIDIA. We're not going to abandon your market, even with all the restrictions by the Trump administration on exports of our ships. So you can count on us. This is enormous, Nima. You have the CEO of the top chip behemoth in China going to Beijing to say, look, you are very important for my company, and I'll do everything to keep our relations sound. Why did he do that? First of all, because he needs the Chinese market. And second, if he doesn't cultivate the Chinese market, guess what? The Chinese, in a matter of 2 to 3 years, maybe maximum 4, they will have what he has now, and they can kill him in the market. And not only the Chinese market, but the global market. So Huang is protecting his flanks as well. And he could even in the future, depending on how the tariff war goes, he could offer a partnership with the Chinese. Or he could even delocalize his factories from the US to China. Anything is possible. If he goes on like this, he knows that he could be smashed by the tariffs. So you see, this is a subplot in the tariff war that's immensely important. There are a lot of businesses from all over who are getting their marching orders to go to Beijing and talk to them, strike a deal, delocalize to China, whatever. Don't abandon the Chinese market, you name it, you know. And of course, in terms of general trade, it's what's happening in the Canton Fair right now as we speak. People from all over 200 countries going to the Canton Fair to buy everything that China produces. So how these people think that with tariffs and barriers, they're going to prevent this, let's say, this global movement of trade? They can't. Simple. They will isolate the US, which may be one of their fantasies. For what? We don't know. For what long term? None of us know, really. Because in terms of sanitizing the American economy, it's not going to work. The costs will be paid by American workers. Everybody knows that. American companies that delocalize, they cannot relocalize back to the US in a matter of 1, 2, or 3 years. It's at least 4 years for a complex operation like that, coming back, setting up everything, chains of production, training workers, you name it. So the mendacity, the overall mendacity of the whole scheme is really mind-boggling. And you don't need to be Jeffrey Sachs to understand that. You can be a taxi driver in New York City and you will understand that.
Yeah. When I look at the Asia and the way that you've mentioned China is trying to connect with Malaysia and Vietnam, and ASEAN, they're making their own circle of countries. But on the other hand, you see Russia and Iran are doing everything in order to have something, some sort of unity, considering Central Asia. You see, everything is changing in that region. And as the American hegemony is just contracting, just reducing in the region, we saw the defense minister of Saudi Arabia going to Iran and talking. This is the outcome of what Russia and China did in the Middle East. And do you think that Donald Trump and his administration are somehow understanding what's going on?
No, they don't.
On the part of Russia, China, Iran, and what's going on?
No, they don't. They don't, Nima, because first of all, they don't know how multilateral organizations, how powerful they are, and how they are becoming even more powerful. They don't know about this interlocking strategic partnerships. They overestimate the size and the power of the American economy. So basically, they don't know how fragile the American economy is and how delocalized it is and how it doesn't produce literally anything. And to restart producing again, it will take years. They don't know all that, of course. So basically, these are fantasies enveloped in xenophobia and racism. Never forget that. It's the same racism manifested against Iran, the decades of Iranophobia, against lens of Islam as a whole, Islamophobia, against Russia, which still won, especially in Europe, Russophobia, and against China, because now China is strong. So xenophobia, which used to be mild before, now is ultra hardcore, because now you are facing power on the planet. And you have to deal with it. You have to respect it, And you have, if you're thinking about spheres of influence, okay. But in terms of trade, China's sphere of influence is global. China's a global trading power. And there's nothing the U.S. can offer to anybody anywhere to counteract, manufacture high-quality Chinese products. At once again, the example of the Canton Fair this week. Why you have people from literally all over the planet going to a fair like this? Because they know they will get there and they will find first-class products by a top manufacturing power with their supply chains that they can get in a matter of days in many cases. Does the US have anything remotely similar? Of course not. They can sell overpriced F-35s. And that's about it. You know, I'll give a very simple example. I used to buy an excellent jeans brand from California. It was called J Brand. It was years ago, it was probably the best jeans on the planet. First class, designed in the US, made in California. Problem was too expensive. So what happened? They delocalized to Indonesia. So the next jeans that I bought, whatever I was at, was made in Indonesia. It was still very, very good, but the price continued with gigantic markup, you know. So what happened after a few years? They went out of business. What the hell? This is an American product. They could inundate the world with this first-class jeans, and made in Indonesia was costing them much less, but no. They prefer to keep the markup. And now, these past few days, this markup miss was totally demystified all over the place because the Chinese themselves, they start going on TikTok and showing to American consumers, you know that Coach bag that you pay $30,000 in New York City? We make them here. You know how much they cost? $300. Can you imagine fashion victims all over the US and the West when they look at that? No, it's not made in Italy. It's not made in Britain. It's not made in France. It's made here, China, world capital of manufacturing. So the fact that they managed with a few TikTok videos to totally explode the scam in the luxury market on a global level, this is beyond brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant, you know. And the West will never learn. They'll never learn. And it's all about markups. It's all about excessive profits based on manufacturing nations where they're giving steady jobs to large parts of their population. This is how it started in China. And then it went all over the place. It went to Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Bangladesh, etc. It's the same model everywhere. To supply the West, to supply different markets in the West, including the luxury market. They cannot manufacture anything anymore in the US, period. And if we compare to European, it's even cheaper in the West compared to European costs. If you manufacture in Europe, like the Italian luxury market, less than 0.00001% can afford it.
Pepe, what's so amazing to me when it comes to China and the United States is how the United States tried to force its hegemony all over the world. It's based on fear and some sort of security agreement. But when it comes to China, it's all about the benefit. Who's going to benefit more? People are getting closer to China because they're going to benefit from China. And China would benefit from them. This is the two-way sort of trade. But when it comes to the United States, it's all the same. They're not going to change it. They don't even consider any sort of, I don't know, modification, any sort of somehow trim it and make it better and improve it. There is nothing there. Even with the Trump administration, many people, these people who voted for Donald Trump, they were hoping some sort of change in the United States. But you see, they're getting the same. They're unifying BRICS and BRICS countries.
Well, so it's positive for the global majority. In fact, it's, by the way, China will use a monster Sun Tzu move from now on. They're going to use the absolutely demential move and attack of the adversary to unbalance him even more. And obviously, the adversary would never expect that. Trump was sure that with this 245% of the Chinese, they're going to pick up the phone and call me and make a deal. No, not anymore. So they don't even know how to judge how the international conjuncture is completely different from what it was, let's say 20 years, 25 years ago. At the beginning of the millennium was much different. And China at the time was still growing. They were entering the World Trade Organization at the time. So they had a long way ahead. It's a completely different situation now. And even to 10 years ago, the way what I find fascinating is that, for instance, BRICS and SCO, they took a long time to take off as organizations. I remember BRICS meetings in the 2000s where they were not going anywhere, but they were very, very, there were no news coming out of it. It was basically talk, talk, talk. SCO, the same thing. I went to several SCO roundtables and all that, and it was basically talk, talk, talk. And suddenly, you had them springing up as great multilateral organizations and appealing to most of the global South and the global majority. And the past BRICS summit in Kazan was something immensely impressive. Immensely impressed. Thanks to the way the Russians spent the whole year making it, okay, this is going to be a huge success. And it was, you know, beyond all expectations. And at the same time, all these multilateral organizations and individual governments, they started to understand that, look, we need to have common positions on serious issues. It's like what was not possible after 1955 at the Bandung conference, where we had all the heavyweights sitting on the same table. It was the beginning of the non-aligned movement, and it could have been very, very strong. It was destroyed by the US because they were not powerful enough. Now it's different. Now you can have a sort of mega non-aligned movement on a global level that is strong enough, and they can, when they act strongly as a whole, they can even intimidate the empire. So the reaction of the global South alongside China to the tariffs will show to the empire that, look, you can, the bullying all across the global South is over. It's not only bullying China, it's bullying all of us global South. You know, you think you can start bomb Iran tomorrow? No, you can't, because you're going to have to deal with Russia and China as well. So you can bomb Yemen because you're cowards. And this is exactly what they're doing. They are so cowardly that they are bombing, technically, the poorest nation in the Arab world, although it's the most sophisticated of them all by eons, you know, because they can. Because they can. Why? Because to send a message. Their own terminology. Send a message is, if I'm not mistaken, was a Hegseth or Waltz. One of those clowns, anyway. But I think it was Hegseth. To send a message. Like, you cannot you have to be in favor of a genocide. You cannot be against a genocide. So we bomb you. We bomb you because you're against a genocide. So this is the message that the Global South looks at the bombing of Yemen and he gets from them. And still, have they managed to subdue Yemen? No, and they will never be able to subdue it. And Yemen is humiliating these clowns on a daily basis and will continue to be that. So if a small regional power like Yemen can do that, can you imagine the collective power of the global south? So anybody with a brain left in the empire looks at the chessboard at the moment and say, oh man, we isolated themselves. We are in deep trouble because basically what do we have? The vassals in Europe. Who cares about the vassals in Europe? They are, you know, plunging into their own suicidal pit. And on top of it, they are despised by the Americans. But, you know, this renewed power of the global South and the global majority compared to the situation in the 50s, this is a measure of auspiciousness, to be very Chinese about it, for all of us. You know, the thing is, if these political elites will be at their highest level to make it work. We know, for instance, Xi and Putin are. To be very frank with you, Nima, I'm not sure Pezeshkian is. I would say Ayatollah Khamenei is, but I'm not sure Pezeshkian is. Lula, to a certain extent, is. And if he finds a way to shine at the summit in Rio, he will pick it up. And he knows how to do it. And he enjoys enormous soft power all across the global south. So we are counting on Lula, of course. But there are not many. There are not many. Can you imagine MBS or MBZ being leaders of the global majority? Of course not. They're a bunch of gangsters.
Pepe, I think you mentioned Europe, and it's so important to see Europe today and the way that China sees. As we know, Russia is totally disappointed with Europe, and they don't know what would be the future between Russia and Europe. But how does it seem? How does it work for China? What do they want, and what do they see in Europe in terms of the conflict between the United States and China?
Well, they see an opening, Nima, for a large trade deal with the European Union. Well, the Europeans also saw that. The Europeans said, look, are we going to be a bunch of chihuahuas and on top of it clobbered by our master every day? No, we need a way out. Their way out in terms of trade would be to send a delegation to Beijing, which is what's going to happen. Okay, let's rewire our possible large trade deal. So this from the point of view of individual nations inside the EU, we don't know how good this is going to be. But the leadership in Brussels already saw that they have only one way out of this, to do a mega deal with China. And the Chinese, of course, they're not going to say no. So I'm very curious to see the result of this of these negotiations, probably in late June, early July. By the way, by the time of the BRICS summit.
Just to wrap up this session, Pepe.
Yes.
And you said that you're going to be in Iran. And unfortunately, I'm not going to be there.
Unfortunately, you're not going to be there, Nima. But I'll keep you updated on everything. And if you have questions, please tell me. So I can put your questions to some characters.
Do you think that the negotiation, the talks between Iran and the United States, do you see Witkoff capable of doing it? Because we know that Israelis are doing everything
to influence
the talks.
It's absolutely. Yes. So it's going to be very hard.
How are they, in your opinion? Are we going to see the same sort of attitude as we're witnessing in Ukraine, or the case of Iran and the United States would be different somehow?
I prefer to wait, Nima. For the moment, the fact that Witkoff, after two sessions, you know, he was not so bad after these two sessions. And apparently he talks and he listens. Coming from an America delegation, this is already gigantic, you know. The problem is this, the pressure is under by the whole of Team Trump 2.0, the Zionist axis, the donors, you name it. So let's see, is if there is one positive aspect of all that, is that Witkoff comes back to DC and tells Trump straight in his face, said, look, these guys over there, they're very rational. We can strike a deal that is rational as long as everybody respects us, including us. So can we imagine Witkoff being diplomat enough to do that? And don't forget, he's not a diplomat. He's a real estate developer. It's a different story. So if he's, some of my friends in Washington are saying that he's very smart. We don't know. If he's smart enough, then it's amazing. He will accomplish an absolutely impossible job, which is to make the Iranians, I wouldn't say trust, but at least have a minimal measure of trust that if they sign a deal with the US again, this deal is not going to be destroyed afterwards. But it's a very long way, Nima, and you know it very well. It's an enormous stretch. And it depends essentially from one guy. It's not even a delegation, you know. It depends on the special envoy of the President of the United States. So Trump will be listening only to him. Trump, okay, what did you talk with the Iranians in Oman? Okay, what did they tell you about? That's it. So it's up to him. The success or failure of these negotiations, wow, can you believe it? We all depend on a New York state developer. So we're going to have a hot war or not. This is where we are at the moment. It's as crazy as it is. This is the situation at the moment.
Exactly. Thank you so much, Pepe.
Muito obrigado.
Grande abraço do Brasil para China.
Vou mandar um grande abraço. Bom, aqui, grande abraço seu para Hong Kong e no Irã, um grande abraço seu para todo mundo inteiro.
Exatamente.
Tchau, tchau. Tchau, tchau. Bye, bye.